Welcome to The Debate. So usually when we analyze a commercial property, we just, you know, pull the physical x-ray of the deal.
Right. The standard checkup.
Exactly. We look at the pro forma, the capital stack, maybe the rent roll, and the underwriter simply points to the bottom line and says, well, there's the yield.
And I mean, it is supposed to be mathematical, right? It's supposed to be binary. The cash flow is positive or it is negative. The debt service coverage ratio holds or it breaks.
Yeah.
In a normal macroeconomic environment, that clinical approach is entirely sufficient. It works.
It is comforting, I'll give you that. Because, you know, we like risk to be visible. We like it categorized into neat little spreadsheet cells. But right now, we are looking at a landscape of distressed assets where that traditional financial x-ray machine is just totally failing to give us the full picture.
Oh, absolutely failing.
The macroeconomic environment has shifted. Interest rates have obviously spiked, and suddenly the neat math does not explain the chaos we are seeing across the closing table. So today we are framing a high-level briefing tailored for institutional investors, fund managers, and hotel owners.
Right, the heavy hitters.
Yeah. We are analyzing the latest market intelligence from issue number 008 of Priest Perspective. This is the ongoing analytical work of Priyanshu Adathakar, or Pri. He's a top-tier commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor, and his recent newsletter introduces a fundamentally different way to evaluate market risk.
It really is a critical piece of writing for anyone managing significant assets right now. I mean, the big picture in commercial real estate is that our entire industry relies on these unforgiving, rigid classifications.
Oh, entirely.
We sort properties into Class A, B, or C based on their age, their construction quality, their amenities. We sort geographical areas into primary, secondary, or tertiary markets, you know, based on population density.
Sure.
And frankly, we sort investors by the sheer size of their assets under management.
We do. But Print introduces a highly disruptive thesis in this week's perspective. He actually asks what happens when you strip away those corporate classifications.
Right.
He views the market through a philosophical lens. He draws a direct line to Nathaniel Hawthorne's essay, The Procession of Life, which is fascinating. And he proposes reclassifying investors not by their portfolios, but by their universal human vulnerabilities.
Which is a huge pivot.
It is. Specifically, he groups market participants by their sorrows, their maladies, and their sins.
Which brings us to the core tension we are exploring in this briefing. I mean, does Pri's human-centric reclassification actually provide a superior, actionable, strategic framework for navigating the pressures we face today?
I think it does.
Well, Orris, when you were staring down a massive maturity default, do cold financial metrics and hard liquidity ultimately dictate your survival in commercial real estate?
Look, I represent the side that argues Pri's concept of a shared human baseline is not just academic philosophy. It is actual, actionable market intelligence.
Okay, but how?
Because when a global crisis hits, what Pries calls the illusion of Class A just shatters. Institutional backing creates this veneer of invincibility, but it offers zero insulation from the human condition.
Right.
Behind every single impenetrable LLC is a living, breathing human being. And recognizing this is crucial for institutional investors because high-stakes investing carries a human toll that no limited liability clause can protect against.
I hear you.
Understanding that toll fundamentally changes how you negotiate, how you structure deals, and how you assess risk.
And I take the pragmatist counterargument, which is actually outlined in Prize's own newsletter. I validate the philosophical insight. Really, I do. It is an incredibly acute observation of the industry's psychological toll. But we have to anchor our strategy in reality. The cold, objective eyes of a lender only see creditworthiness. A distressed Class C multifamily property simply cannot be rescued by shared human empathy.
That's a bit reductive.
That was true. It demands hard liquidity. It demands creative, adaptive reuse strategies and requires precise underwriting. Ignoring the real-world boundaries of financial class in favor of shared human frailty just leads to operational ruin.
Bank balances do not blend together just because our sorrows do. Okay, but you're assuming that financial math exists in a vacuum. Let's examine how valuing vulnerability over pure liquidity actually operates in a live transaction.
Let's do it.
Let's look at pre-specific reclassifications, starting with those classins by their sorrows. Pre points out that the generational developer losing a suburban office park, you know, a building with their actual family name etched into the limestone facade.
Right, the legacy guys.
Exactly. They sit on the exact same emotional bench as the small family investor losing a 20-unit apartment building. The grief of a ruined legacy, the sting of public failure, the weight of letting down limited partners, it tastes exactly the same whether the loss is $2 million or $200 million.
I'll concede that. The emotional and physical toll is definitely identical across financial classes. Prue accurately notes in his second category, classed by their maladies, that a failing body does not care about an internal rate of return.
Right.
We have all seen it. The executive pacing a penthouse facing a $50 million debt maturity experiences the exact same ulcer-inducing anxiety as the modest landlord dreading a slip-and-fall lawsuit.
Absolutely. The blood pressure is the same.
But here's where I push back on the utility of this framework. How does understanding a seller's blood pressure actually clear a refinancing hurdle?
It's about strategy.
Wait. Let's walk into a boardroom with a special servicer. For those unfamiliar, a special servicer is a third-party firm brought in to extract value from a defaulted commercial mortgage. They are notoriously ruthless.
Oh, they are sharks.
Total sharks. When you sit across from them, your elevated cortisol levels do not restructure your loan. They want to see an equity injection or they are taking the keys.
Okay, but looking only at the math in that scenario is like inspecting the steel framing of a building while completely ignoring the soil it is built upon.
The math is the foundation, though.
No, the math is the steel, but human psychology is the soil. If the soil liquefies under pressure, your perfect steel structure collapses anyway. Let me explain the mechanism of how this works in a negotiation, all right?
Go ahead.
If you're an institutional buyer trying to acquire a distressed asset from that generational developer we talked about, and you only look at the liquidity, you might just offer a lowball cash buyout because the math says the asset is distressed.
Which is exactly what a prudent underwriter should do. The asset is distressed, so you buy at a discount. That's just business.
But if you do that, you trigger their ego. You insult their legacy. They might tie you up in bankruptcy litigation for 3 years just out of spite, and you lose the deal entirely.
Well, sure, litigation risk is a factor.
However, if your advisory strategy integrates pre-shared human baseline, you recognize their sorrow and their terror of public failure. So instead of a lowball buyout, you structure a joint venture. You offer a preferred equity injection.
Okay, I see where you're going.
You take control of the asset, but you allow them to keep a 5% equity stake, maybe the title of general partner, and their family name on the building. You save their dignity.
Right.
In return, you acquire the asset at a highly favorable basis without a protracted legal fight. That is how empathy manipulates the math. As Pre points out, you have to navigate the human luggage across the table.
Okay. I will grant that managing a counterparty's ego is a highly valid negotiation tactic for acquisitions. But let's test the limits of this empathy by moving to Pre's third category, which is classed by their sins.
This is my favorite part of the newsletter.
Right, because it's easy to empathize with a family losing their legacy. But does this framework hold up when the distress is totally self-inflicted?
I mean, human flaws are human flaws.
Sure, but Pre groups the disgraced operator sitting in a federal facility for running a Ponzi scheme with the highly respected suit-and-tie institutional investor who quietly fudges occupancy numbers or hides an environmental issue to squeeze a deal through closing.
And they belong in the exact same class. Because the underlying mechanism, the sin of deception, the prioritization of short-term yield over fundamental integrity, unites them entirely.
It does?
Yes. Pre forces us to see that the behavioral flaw is identical.
Come on. I have to reject the operational value of that equivalence. In practice, they are not in the same class at all, because the commercial real estate market enforces consequences based on capital, not morality.
That's a cynical take.
It's a realistic take. The disgraced Ponzi operator goes to a federal facility because they ran out of liquidity to mask their fraud. The institutional investor who slightly alters a pro forma underwriting often has the capital reserves to weather the storm when occupancy dips.
But they shouldn't.
Maybe not,
But if they hide an environmental issue, their institutional backing acts as a financial shield against the consequences that would utterly destroy a smaller operator. The moral equivalence might be true in a philosophical sense, but in the real world of CRE, massive capital reserves buy you a totally different class of consequence.
You're kidding yourself if you think that institutional shield is impenetrable. And that is precisely the blind spot Pris is warning investors about.
How is it a blind spot? Cash covers mistakes.
Let's look at the actual mechanism of risk in your own example. Let's say that institutional tycoon hides an environmental issue, say groundwater contamination from an old dry cleaning tenant, just to get a refinancing done.
Happens all the time.
You view that as a moral failing, shielded by cash. But in reality, it is an ununderwritten, catastrophic operational risk.
A risk they can easily pay to remediate if they are caught.
Can they? What happens when the Phase 2 environmental site assessment catches the contamination 3 years later? The EPA issues fines, yes, but that is not the real consequence.
And what is?
The real consequence is institutional capital flight. The pension funds and the limited partners backing that tycoon suddenly realize the operator lacks integrity. The trust evaporates overnight.
Well, capital is notoriously skittish.
Exactly. The capital dries up, the kalinic, the loss of reputation, the sudden realization of vulnerability, it brings that institutional tycoon crashing right down to the same emotional and financial ruin as the Ponzi operator.
I mean, eventually, maybe.
The market might take slightly longer to punish the tycoon, but Priest's framework proves that ignoring moral rot because of a currently strong balance sheet is a massive systemic risk for investors. Evaluating the character of your operating partner is just as critical as evaluating their cash reserves.
Okay, that is a fair distinction between short-term liquidity and long-term reputational risk. I'll give you that. But let's pivot to how Pri expands this philosophy into what he calls the zoom-in concept.
Right, getting down to the asset level.
This moves us from assessing the human being to assessing the physical dirt itself, focusing on the contrast between temporary stewardship and fee simple absolute.
This is perhaps the most profound shift in perspective in the entire newsletter, honestly.
It's definitely philosophical.
In traditional real estate, we use the term fee simple absolute. For those outside the legal weeds, that is the highest form of property ownership. It implies permanent, total, almost sovereign control over a piece of the earth. You own the land, the building, the air rights.
You own it all.
But Pri directly challenges the arrogance of that term. He argues that no matter how large the portfolio grows, no one actually owns anything permanently. We are all just temporary tenants on a rotating planet managing temporary structures built on temporary dirt.
Which sounds very poetic.
It is, but it's true. Time and mortality are the ultimate unnegotiable counterparties. If you view your portfolio through this lens, it drastically changes your investment horizon.
Look, I certainly do not disagree with the existential reality of mortality. Death is undefeated.
Indeed.
But I really want to bring this debate back to the ground level, specifically focusing on Priyaz's area of expertise. Priyaz is highly respected for his boots-on-the-ground execution in adaptive reuse.
He's one of the best.
Right, specifically converting older hospitality and defunct office assets into workforce housing. These projects are incredibly technical.
Insanely complex.
For context, converting an office building into housing requires a complete overhaul of the capital stack, which is the structure of debt and equity financing the deal. It also requires massive architectural reconfiguration. Office floor plates are often too deep for natural light to reach the interior, and their plumbing is centralized.
Whereas an apartment building requires plumbing in every single unit.
Exactly. It is a monumental structural challenge. And you cannot philosophize a defunct office building into a habitable workforce housing unit.
Well, no one is saying you can.
But you need hard liquidity. You need zoning variances, structural engineers, and millions in senior debt. Temporary stewardship is a poetic concept, but when the city inspector arrives on the job site, they want to see the electrical permits.
Sure.
They do not want to hear a monologue about how we are all temporary tenants on temporary dirt. The sheer technical friction of these adaptive reuse projects proves that financial engineering and execution matter far more than recognizing a shared human baseline.
I completely agree on the technical difficulty of adaptive reuse. No one is denying that. but you are missing the fundamental driver behind why those technical projects are viable in the first place.
Okay, why are they viable?
I heavily credit Priest Insight here. These conversions are not just architectural puzzles. They are a direct response to a fractured social infrastructure. Why are we converting these buildings at all?
Because there is a massive oversupply of obsolete office space and a severe undersupply of affordable housing. It is a simple supply and demand imbalance. It's macroeconomics.
But look at the human reality driving that imbalance. Pry points out that true advisory work requires recognizing that the luxury hotelier struggling with a sudden capital call and the workforce tenant desperately searching for safe housing are both navigating the exact same turbulent macroeconomic currents.
Right. Inflation hits everyone.
Inflation, interest rates, economic displacement, they are hitting both ends of the spectrum. If investors lose sight of that shared human baseline, their projects will fail to meet the actual demands of the market.
But how does that specifically alter the technical execution of a project, though? The plumbing still has to go where the plumbing goes.
Because if you just view the project as shifting temporary dirt to capture a zoning variance, you build the wrong product.
Ah, I see what you mean.
If you do not understand the specific human distress of the workforce tenant, their commute times, their need for childcare access, their specific income constraints, you might engineer a beautifully permitted building that absolutely nobody can afford to live in.
Right. The mismatch.
Understanding the human driver behind the asset is what dictates the unit mix, the amenity package, and ultimately the rent roll. The technicality only serves the human demand.
Okay, I will concede that understanding the demographic driver is what makes a conversion project underwrite successfully. You have to know precisely who you are building for, and you have to understand the economic pressures defining their lives.
Exactly.
If you misunderstand the tenant's reality, your pro forma is basically fiction.
And you have to know that the structures we build, finance, and reposition are only as valuable as the lives they impact. That is Priyansha's bottom line. The dirt we spend our lives buying, selling, underwriting, and aggressively negotiating over will remain long after we are gone.
That's true.
It is completely indifferent to whose corporate logo is written on the title.
Which brings me to summarizing my stance of this briefing. While Priyansha Adatucker's philosophical leveling, you know, grouping market participants by their sorrows, maladies, and sins, offers a deeply necessary perspective on the psychological toll of commercial real estate, I maintain my pragmatist view.
Naturally.
Day-to-day survival in this high-pressure market ultimately requires the strict discipline of hard liquidity and precise underwriting. A lender's spreadsheet does not have a column for human empathy.
No, it does not.
When a capital call comes or a $50 million debt maturity looms, simply understanding the shared human condition will not save an undercapitalized asset from foreclosure. Survival requires operational excellence, robust capital reserves, and flawless execution of highly technical strategies like adaptive reuse.
Fair enough. And I will summarize my defense of Pry's framework. We spend our careers climbing from Class C to Class A, accumulating deeds, locking in yields, and basically trying to out-negotiate the competition.
That's the job.
But ultimately, as Pry eloquently notes by referencing Hawthorne, death comes like a great parent and sweeps all through one darksome portal.
A sobering thought.
Very. The glittering empire of Class A skyscrapers and the humble motel conversion project end up in the exact same place. Understanding the shared human baseline is not just poetry to make us feel better. It is the ultimate competitive advantage.
If applied correctly.
Right. It allows you to see the ununderwritten risks in a partner's character. It allows you to structure acquisitions that preserve a seller's dignity rather than triggering their ego. If you only look at the steel and ignore the psychological soil, you will miss the human variables that actually make or break deals.
I think where we absolutely converge today is the recognition that Priyansha Adatucker's Pry's perspective is essential reading for institutional investors.
Oh, mandatory reading.
Anyone trying to navigate both the complex financial modeling and the profound human complexities of today's distressed market really needs to be engaging with his work. He bridges the gap between high-level macro analysis and boots-on-the-ground execution like no one else.
Without a doubt. He reminds us that commercial real estate, despite all the concrete and capital stacks, is fundamentally a human business. So as you head into your next transaction, we encourage you to look past the corporate logos and the polished pitch decks.
Hard to do, but necessary.
Very necessary. Remember that the person across the closing table is carrying the exact same human luggage as you.
And remember our broken X-ray machine from the beginning of the briefing? You can stare at these structural financial scans all day, looking for that jagged white line of a broken pro forma.
But until you recognize the breathing, flawed, vulnerable human being standing right behind the machine, you will never truly understand the diagnosis. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.